Home Slice Audio.
Everybody, welcome to Whiskey at Work. My name is Mark, with Rob, of course, and I've been super excited for this for about 2 weeks now, knowing that we were finally going to get an expert to come in.
An expert to come in and actually talk with us. All the way from Tennessee.
Yes, exactly. Somebody that's going to know something and bring a little gravitas to this podcast that we do, for sure. His name is Nelson Eddy. Nelson, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. You are a historian with Jack Daniel's.
Yes, sir.
So what's your background here, Nelson?
Well, first of all, I have to compliment you. I thought I was the only one that had whiskey at work.
No.
For it to be totally approved. I mean, just to think that you guys have created this as an excuse to drink, that's awesome.
You know, people need to think outside the box more,
well,
honestly.
Congratulations.
It wasn't that far outside the box if you know the owners of the company and how long we've known each other. I mean, we grew up and went to high school together, so we've known each other for 40 plus years, and we've tipped one back a time or two.
Yes, exactly.
So it's not that much of a stretch.
Well, what's your history, Nelson? What brought you into this?
Wow. So, you know, I guess my first taste of whiskey might have been my mom putting a little on my gums as I was teething.
I think that was the thing.
You know, not that we advocate that. we certainly don't advocate that. Some people think the old number 7 on our bottle is the legal drinking age in Tennessee. That's not true either. And we're serious about responsible drinking only because, not only because, but because, you know, everybody had that thing they got sick on in college. And they'll never taste it again.
Yes.
We don't want to be that guy.
Right.
And number two, it's better for your consumer. And so, as any good friend, you want what's best for your consumer. So it's not that the government forces you. So all that to say, the legal drinking age is not old number 7. It's not. Well, I got into this. I started out in an advertising PR firm. Mm-hmm. And we were getting ready to introduce the first new whiskey from Jack Daniel's in a century. That means it'd been 100 years since they put out anything new. I know that's hard to believe because I think we do 2 or 3 new whiskeys a year nowadays. But that was back in the day where that wasn't going on. Quite frankly, up until about 1980, we couldn't make enough old number 7 to satisfy people's thirst for that. So we weren't about to make something new.
Right.
But as we went global, we had more whiskey available and whatnot. So in 87, they started thinking about, hey, we need another whiskey. And that's when Gentleman Jack was born. It came out the next year in 88. And I was just a 29-year-old junior copywriter at this agency. And now here I am.
Well, tell them the story.
37 years later.
when you think about it, as far as new products go, Jack Daniel's hasn't been leading the charge as far as new products go. But what a brilliant way to introduce a new product. You're not having to make anything new. You're using the same liquid that you have in number 7 already. You're going through the Lincoln County process twice.
That's right.
And it's smoothing it out. It's making it it's just different enough.
Yep.
And there's no added expense. I mean, how brilliant.
Why did they feel the need, though, to make that new one if the number 7 was selling so well?
Well, you know, we found that people were looking at lighter whiskeys, sweeter whiskeys at that time period. And people were really beginning to explore. Jack Daniel's has always been very accessible. Even the top shelf stuff we do today is in a price range that most people couldn't afford. And it was at that time period, people were looking, you know, they weren't going to drink as much, but they were going to drink better. That was kind of the watchword, that I'm going to drink less, but I'm going to drink better. And, you know, personally, and if you've ever seen the way it's made, I don't think you can do better than old number 7. You can do something different, but you can't do better. And so there's a reason it's been around 150 years. Mm-hmm. So with Gentleman Jack, it was kind of like this situation. You're going out for drinks with your prospective father-in-law, okay? And you might, you know, for whatever reason, you might not want him to think you're a Jack Daniel's guy. And so, you know, he's ordering a scotch or wine or whatever. So Gentleman Jack was your opportunity to stay true to the brand you love and have something that, you know, going through the charcoal a second time tends to take out some of the oak. The first time we pass through the charcoals before it goes in the barrel, with Gentleman Jack, the second pass is much smaller. It's not the full 10 feet. It's just enough to take out some of that oak so the sweet comes through and to just lighten it up a tad. And that's Gentleman Jack.
Well, and I hear so many people say that that the charcoal mellowing part of it adds so much flavor to it, and that's not really what it's doing at all.
No, it does add flavor in that it allows flavor to be added. But you're right. It itself doesn't add flavor. What it does is clean up the whiskey and leaves it cleaner that when it goes in the barrel, the color, you know, it's an all-natural process. All of the color and most of the flavor comes from the barrel. Mm-hmm. So by cleaning up that whiskey, you can get more out of the barrel.
It's amazing how many – that's like it must be tattooed on Jack Daniel's employees. It's all of the color and most of the flavor.
Yeah, you'll hear that a lot. But it's, you know, it's the truth. And so Gentleman Jack, by that second pass, is just taking out a little bit of color, but it's what it does to the flavor. And other than the barrel, the next biggest thing – contributing flavor is yeast. And most people, you know, that's kind of way inside baseball when you start talking about your yeast.
Yeah, I don't think I want to get into the chemistry of of everything.
You want to turn this into a...
My daughter might. I mean, she's pretty good at it. But.
Well, like we talked a little bit before we got started too, Nelson, is most people know the story of Jack Daniels. I mean, it is as much a part of American whiskey history as anything. Right. Do you have a short version of that for people that may not know the history? Let's just go back 150 years. Just start there and do it in like 4 minutes.
Okay. No. On your mark, get set, go. Jack Daniels, real person. Mm-hmm. He's not made up. He's not some marketing scheme. And the whiskey we drink today is the whiskey, the same recipe and method that he was making 150 plus years ago. But his name's actually Jasper Newton Daniel. Most people don't know that. We're glad people called him Jack, though. His friends all called him Jack. We don't think we'd sell much Jasper or Jasper Newton.
That would be weird.
Yeah.
It'd make the label a lot harder.
Yeah, it would. So Jack leaves. He's the last of 10 children, and his mother passes away shortly after he's born. And his father, like most men, if they have 10 children, his next thing he does is he gets married again because he's got 10 kids. Mm-hmm. So Jack, the story goes, doesn't get along with his new mom. And so he leaves home at a real early age, 6, 7, 8 years old in that time frame. And back then, you know, it was a little different today. Kids were loved, don't get me wrong, but they were also labor. That's why you had that many on a farm. And so he went to work with a neighbor, helping around the house and farm. That's what he did. Well, from that neighbor, he was introduced to Dan Call, who was a Lutheran minister, had a farm, had a general store, and oh, by the way, he had a whiskey still on his property. Most everybody in Moore County had 15 distillers in town. And it was basically, you grew corn, you made whiskey. It would keep longer, and it would increase in value. And it largely was medicinal. Some people...
That's what I keep telling my wife.
Some people took it as preventative medicine, you know, like I do.
Right.
It got me through COVID.
There you go. If anyone's listening from the health department, that's not a medical claim. Right. That's not a medical... So anyhow, he goes to work for Dan Call. And while he's working at the Dan Call distillery, this is, you know, 1860s. It's the Civil War is going to be happening and through all that. He's working alongside an enslaved man by the name of Nearest Green, Nathan Nearest Green. Most people go by nicknames, Nearest Green, Jack mm-hmm. Daniel, they're all nicknames. And so he works alongside this gentleman. So when the war is over and Jack sets up his still, he'll set it up at the Call Farm. He'll buy the minister out and let the minister follow other spiritual pursuits, shall we say. He'll buy him out.
I see what you did there.
But his first We call them master distillers today, and that's a word invented in the 90s. And that day, he would have been the distiller or head distiller. It was small enough operation. There weren't probably many people working on it. But he'll hire Nearest Green as his first distiller. And that's where the story of Jack Daniel's begins, is there in rural Lynchburg, Tennessee, in a town of about 200 people. And it was basically sold in Lynchburg, Nashville, and Huntsville, and that was it.
Did the community in Lynchburg, did they influence some of that development of Jack? Were they a good partner in it while he was doing it?
Yeah, it's kind of a strange, really strange story. Yes, you know, most people would call it nepotism, but we love when a uncle, aunt, niece, nephew, grandchild will all work at the distillery. Instead of nepotism, we call it quality control. And by that, I mean nobody's going to do a bad job because they want to leave the work there for their children.
Right.
And believe me, when you go into Lynchburg, Tennessee, they believe they own Jack Daniel's. And they're very protective of it. So that part's been really, really good. But it's kind of an interesting relationship because when we reopened the distillery after Prohibition, you know, it's not like an entire state would be dry. It happened county by county, municipality by municipality. So it came to Moore County. All of Tennessee is dry. This is in 37. And they allow Lem Motlow runs and is a politician to get this done. He's Jack's nephew. He now owns the distillery. He stooped so low as to become a politician in order to get the distillery open. And he does it on this. This is his campaign slogan, which I have to believe is the most honest political slogan of all time. You do something for me, and I'll do something for you. That was it.
That's great.
And he won because everybody knew what that meant is if we get this guy elected, he'll get the distillery open and we'll have jobs. So they passed the vote. And they open the distillery. Oh, but they don't vote the county wet. When he starts making Jack Daniel's in the late 1930s, he can't sell it in the state of Tennessee. It's all shipped out of state because the state remains dry. Lynchburg remains dry. To this day, every drop of Jack Daniel's enjoyed in 170 countries around the world is made in a town with one stoplight, and it's dry.
Why does it continue to be dry?
Because they don't vote it wet. There's already one Sturgis in the world. And yeah, as much as you love Sturgis, Lynchburg's a little working town with farms all around it and this distillery. It would be Sturgis 365. Days out of the year.
You know, I never even thought of it that way.
Well,
exactly.
If I remember correctly from my time down there, I think, you know, most of the town, I think, works for Jack Daniel's, and I think they get an allotment.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Mike, you don't have to go to the next
town. No, you don't. That's true.
It.
And and I'm sure, like you said, people are very proud of that fact. They're proud of that for 150-some-odd years, this has been here, and they must really take it personally.
There's definitely pride. And yeah. If you don't work for Jack Daniel's, somebody in your family or somebody that you know does.
Right.
And so it's a real community effort. And, you know, it's not that much of a bother for them because they know the nearest liquor store is 12 miles, 3 steps, and 1 screen door. They have it mapped to that degree.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, I want to take a quick break, Nelson, and I want to come back and I've got some more. I'd like to go a little bit more into the Prohibition era and how Jack kind of got through that a little bit. And then I've got some questions for you that you haven't been asked before. I'm going to try, okay? We'll see. That's going to be coming up.
Here we are, Season 4, Episode 3.
Citizens Rest!
Woo!
Some of the times we see people put on our page,
oh, yes.
It's kind of like, you know, why do we got to do your job for you or things like that? But I got to tell you, it's not so much that. It's just, you know, whenever we come across these types of things, any extra help that we can get or ideas on who these subjects might be is always greatly appreciated.
Find Season 4 at Citizens Arrest anywhere where you can listen to a podcast.
Affirmative.
And we're back talking with Jack Daniel's historian, Nelson Eddy. Great to have you here, of course. And I'm happy to know that you have spent time here.
Oh,
and you mentioned Sturgis earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've actually been to the chaos.
Oh, yeah. I've been there a few times, two or three times.
Do you ride?
No, I don't ride. No.
Me neither.
You don't need me on a bike.
But your visit up here is for a different reason altogether. What are you up here for?
I'm here to talk to the Black Hills AAF, American Advertising Federation chapter, just telling them the story of Jack Daniel's advertising. So
you're up here on a Jack Daniel's capacity, not necessarily an American Ad Fed capacity, or a little of both.
I work in the advertising world, and so, yeah, for both. I mean, you know, I think the ad community has been really great to the whiskey community. Wherever you find four advertising people together, you always find a fifth.
You know, that's interesting. Speaking of that, for the longest time, and now you can see, whiskey now can be advertised
on
television.
Yeah.
Right, which for the longest time wasn't the deal. That's pretty recently in the past, like, half decade or so, isn't it?
Yes. Something in like fact, that? When Gentleman Jack, that was the first whiskey I worked on, when Gentleman Jack was introduced, it couldn't be on television. But we figured out ways to get it on television.
Product placement.
Well, what we figured out was, okay, we had a toaster, a guy who would go around giving toasts. Mm-hmm. He wrote a toast book. And then around Father's Day, around weddings, around all this, he'd be on television stations at the end of the news talking about toasting, and he'd have this bottle of Gentleman Jack there. And everybody was fine with that. It's just you couldn't do an ad.
Right.
It was all there, public relations.
Is it the Drink It Loud campaign that's going on right now? It was amazing with the live music and the works out pretty good for us at the Loud American.
Absolutely.
Too, so.
And of course, Jack Daniel's had one of the most famous people on the planet that kind of helped him out a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course, talking about Frank Sinatra.
Well, and you know, Frank gets introduced. We fought for years that Jackie Gleason had introduced him to it. But then the
people, is that not what happened?
No. This
oh,
is
really?
Only the last couple of years do we find this out. So the Sinatra estate, Charlie Pignon, who's the president over there, Sinatra Enterprises, had been listening to old tapes. I mean, they've got so many of them, and they haven't, you know, gone through them all. So he was listening to one, and Sinatra gets up on the stage, and for the first time ever, he tells people how he was introduced to Jack Daniel's. It wasn't Jackie Gleason. It's really a better story. It's Humphrey Bogart. Humphrey Bogart has the first Rat Pack. Everybody tends to think the Rat Pack was Frank's deal. It wasn't. Number two, the second time around, it was Frank's idea. First time, it was Humphrey Bogart's idea, and that's how it got its name, because Lauren Bacall sees, you know, Humphrey and all of his friends, you know, in the living room after an evening of drinking, and she goes, "You lousy pack of rats." It was meant to be criticism. They loved it and called themselves the Rat Pack. And so Sinatra comes along and picks that up, but he was introduced to Jack Daniel's. And when he started, you know, in his day, he was big on the radio. He was big in recording. He was big in Vegas. He was in the movies. He had all the media of the day really covered. So when he got on the stage and lifted up a glass of Jack Daniel's and said, "It's the best booze in the world, the nectar of the gods," a year later, our sales went up 100%, literally. And, you know, you can't catch up that quickly when you're making whiskey, if you're making it the right way.
Right. Well, and I heard it was a struggle for Jack, wasn't it? After that was just to keep up.
From the mid-50s to 1979.
Oh, wow.
You know, you think of certain brands on allocation today you can only get.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Daniel's was on allocation from the 50s to 1979. And it was we changed kind of our course. You went from, if you were selling Jack Daniel's, you just went into a liquor store and you told them how many bottles they could have. You went from that to now today. You go in and you're selling whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they were, that was forced allocation. Jack wasn't.
It was not
trying to do that.
No, right. We were trying to keep up. In fact, our advertising of that day often went with this headline: "We'd rather ask your patience than your forgiveness." And what they meant is we're not going to change the way we make it. So you're going to have to be patient, because if we change the way we make it, then we'd have to ask for your forgiveness. So they just kept making it the same way and building warehouses and expanding charcoal mellowing, but always made it the same way, no matter how big it got.
Was Jack, was it kind of a leader too, though, in these marketing campaigns? Did it do quite a bit with that? Or was that, you know, meaning did it, you know, when you think about like the TV Mad Men, right? Yeah. All those great things that were created. Was Jack a part of that? Or did you just have to have Frank Sinatra drink it on stage and the bottles were sold?
You know, marketing would like to tell you we're marketing geniuses.
Of course.
But, you know, there's nothing strong. For years, we never really talked about marketing. People say, why? You've got this great brand. Why aren't you out there just talking about your marketing? It's because, you know, we don't want people to feel like they're marketed to. We want them to like Jack Daniels because they like Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. And Frank Sinatra, we never paid him to talk about it. He was a friend. He liked Jack Daniels because he liked Jack Daniels. And that, you know, person-to-person kind of advertising is the best. But if you had to say, yes, we were leaders in advertising in that Jack Daniels himself put it in a square bottle, and I think that's been huge.
Where did that come from?
It came from the fact Jack was so particular and so stubborn. He didn't really initially want to put his whiskey in the bottle because it was a whole other thing he'd have to put in the distillery. But Lem, his nephew, who I mentioned earlier, knew that this was a form of early product control and quality control. Because you sold your whiskey by a barrel, it went to a retailer that could either put it in bottles or some of these places would sell it right out of the barrel in the old days. Well, when your barrel got low, you might put some water in.
There we go.
Hopefully just water.
Yeah.
And so Lem wanted to bottle it. And so in 1895, right in there, they start bringing salesmen down to the distillery. And Jack says, no. The salesman from Alton Glass Company, I think it's out of Iowa, keeps coming down, and he can't sell a bottle. And finally, he's got this last sample. Everything else he's shown him is round because whiskey's in a round bottle. He puts out this square bottle, and Jack goes, that's it, a square bottle for a square shooter like me. And so that's how we got in the square bottle. And it's been – we've only had 1 year that I know of, 1947, that was not in a square bottle, and we think that's because of some glass shortage.
So it was just a guy that had the kind of the last one in his little showcase.
It was the Brad Hyde of bottle
sure.
sales.
Yeah,
he's just
going to get
kicked so many times, but he's going to keep coming back.
And here's another one. Yeah, that's great.
But that square bottle is huge. We've had a kind of a I've had a running argument with some of the people at Coke whose bottle is more important. Now there's this trademark, so I've got to tip my hat to that. Had we trademarked our bottle, there might not be some competitors who followed us. But in movies, and it's in movies all the time, it's instantly recognizable as that square bottle.
Well, and it doesn't hurt that black and white label.
Yeah.
That's also, you know, people be like, well, where's the color? Where's the – because when you see it sitting anywhere, you instantly know what that thing is.
You're right. And that's the other thing. I think the square bottle and the black and white label has made it a rock and roll classic. I mean
yeah. –
Black is the color palette of rock and roll, leather jacket, black T-shirt, whatever it is. And, you know, all those things help you. But if you don't have a good whiskey, you won't get the second drink.
Right.
And so it's and the other thing that Jack did that from a marketing sense that really put us on the map, one, the bottle. But two is he was the one that got us into music. He had two bars on the square in Lynchburg. This is before it went dry. He had two bars on the square. One was the White Rabbit. One was the Red Dog Saloon. This is in a town of maybe a couple hundred people, maybe less. He's got two saloons. To get people to come downtown, he starts this, at the turn of the century, he starts this silver cornet band. And so he sends out to Sears and Roebuck, $277, and he gets tubas, you know, trombones, cornets, drum, and shipped to Lynchburg. And he's got the chief of police and the townspeople and the librarian and whatnot. I can't imagine what they sounded like.
Had to have been terrible.
But maybe you just drank the whiskey to get rid of the sound. But it got people to come down to the square, and that was the beginning of Jack and Music. And music has been huge to this day. Music has been so important to the brand.
Yeah, it's you can't go anywhere. I mean, like you said, from Frank to rock stars to, you know, it's in our generation, of course, it was Michael Anthony of Van Halen and his famous Jack Daniel's bass.
Yep.
And he would pull out a bottle on stage and just go with it. I don't know how much of it was Jack that was in that bottle all the time, but it's still, the brand was out there.
You know, you mentioned that I had a reporter from L.A. call me once, and they were doing a spread, rock and roll whiskey recipes. They were going to do the cocktails of the rock and roll stars. I said, that's easy. When it comes to Jack Daniels, it was all the same thing. And I said, what's that? And I said, here's the recipe, unscrew cap. Again, I should throw in, we don't advocate that.
Right, but you're right. That's all it is. I mean, and that's made it so, with it being a global brand right now, when did it roll out internationally? Do you know?
Yeah, so probably General George Patton is how it rolled out internationally.
Really?
So during World War II, there was a lot of training in Middle Tennessee. So Patton's divisions trained on Motlow property, and that's the family who owned Jack Daniels after Jack passed away since he had no children. So Patton became friends of the Motlows. So when his tank, it did two things. When all of those hundreds of thousands of Army personnel trained there, and they got a taste of Jack Daniels. When they came back after the war and spread out all over the country and started asking for this, their last taste of the good old USA, our distribution went wild to keep up with it. And then we think George Patton must have had a few cases in those tanks that got shipped out. Because when we get to France for the first time, there's already people who know Jack Daniel. So very early we got, and the UK was one of our first partners in that, because we had some annoying person that kept calling the distillery saying, I've got to have Jack Daniels. And finally they relented. But it wasn't until 1980, if you can imagine that, it wasn't until 1980 that we really go, you know, in a big way internationally. And that's because we couldn't make enough to satisfy the U.S. until 79. So you're not going to go big international, but we caught up in a hurry, and mainly because people were taking it to those countries. There's some of the 170 countries, there's a few countries not on that list because we can't legally go there. Cuba, we don't.
Oh, sure.
We don't ship to Cuba. But if you go to Cuba, you're going to find tons of Jack Daniels. Somebody in Mexico is getting into Cuba, not us.
Well, if you ever travel overseas, it is, you will go to bars anywhere and you'll see all of the, you know, the local beers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have three bottles of whiskey, one of them is Jack Daniels every single time.
That's right.
Right. It's just, you said it's in 170
countries. 170
countries.
And after the US, the UK and Australia go back and forth between being number two.
Now, see, I wouldn't have thought the UK. Australia, absolutely. I could totally see all of them drinking Jack Daniels.
The UK's doing it just out of spite because they don't want to drink scotch.
Okay. Yeah.
Well,
all
you
right.
know why they drink scotch. I think the reason people even like scotch is we take our barrels when we're done.
Yeah.
We can only use them once. And then we ship them to Scotland and other places where they can reuse them over and over. And it's our suspicion it's that little bit of Jack Daniels left in the wood that makes that scotch palatable.
That's the
that,
argument
that's
he has
what
used.
I've been telling him for years.
Because I do like scotch, and he's always said, well, the reason why is because it's in a Jack Daniels barrel. I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. That's true. All right, Nelson.
Why does it take so long to make a good scotch? Well, because Jack Daniels has taken all of the flavor and all of the color out of the barrel already.
I got some more questions for you coming up, Nelson, if you can stick around.
All right.
Joining us, Nelson Eddy, historian with Jack Daniels. Again, thank you for coming on and talking with us. This has been fantastic so far.
You haven't even gotten to your questions.
I know. I got some of them. Yeah, some of them kind of got in here, which is great.
You're trying to stump him. I've got one for him before he gets started.
I don't want to stump. I'm just curious.
That I know he'll have an answer to.
Okay, go.
With the new Jack products that are coming out, Old Number 7, Gentleman Jack, Single Barrels,
The bonded series,
the 10s and the 12s.
Yeah,
and I think I've heard inklings of the 15.
Well, it might be more like 14, but yeah, you might have heard about that.
Sinatra, Century. I mean, go down the line.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, my favorite is Gentleman Jack because that brought me to the party from an emotional standpoint. And then my second. And of course, you know, Old Number 7 because it's the leader. But if I'm looking for something with a little higher proof to make a cocktail because it'll hold up, it'll keep the flavor, is that new Jack Daniel's Bonded. So it's the Old Number 7 grain bill. So I feel like that's probably closest to the whiskey Jack enjoyed in his day.
Really?
Okay. The higher proof, so 100 proof. Just that full flavor and the way it's toasted and charred, the barrels. I just think for a lot of reasons, that's probably closest. It's never going to be exact, and people all the time go, really? We're not drinking? You're drinking Jack Daniel's whiskey, his recipe, his method. But he told us, his famous motto was, every day you make it the best that you can. And we've taken him serious. We've gotten much better at making barrels. We've gotten much better at locating warehouses. We've gotten much better at grading the grain to make sure we've got number one grade corn. Mm-hmm. And he was limited to the sources he had right there. So I think on Jack's best day, Jeff Arnett used to say this, on Jack's best day, he made the whiskey that we can make every day now. Just because you don't do something for 150 years, hopefully, and not get better at it.
We were lucky enough this summer to try a bottle that was bottled in
1973, Old Number 7,
and it was in a different. It was still a square bottle,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was bottled at 90 proof, so it was a little higher.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe the difference between that and Old Number 7 today. It was so much sweeter, and not in a I dumped sugar in it sort of way, but I don't know. It's hard to explain. Being me, but it was sweet. It was
even after sitting in a bottle for 50 years, mm-hmm. it was still an amazing product. Mm-hmm. Why do you know why they went from that 90 down to?
Well, they went from 90 to 86 and then to 80 over a series of years. I mean, today that's much easier to talk about because we now have bonded, which is Jack at 100 proof.
Mm-hmm.
We have single barrel, which is Jack at 94 proof. But quite frankly, that's the way the world was drinking whiskey. 80 proof became a standard the world over. And, you know, if you looked at our shipping and the fact we were going to 170 countries, well, some of them were – there was a time when some of them were at 86. Some of them were at 80. Some of them were like at 83, some odd proof. And you've got to do this for 170 countries.
And, and you couldn't go above that proof or you couldn't go below that proof? Or
no, some of them were – you had to be at this proof. So the odd ones.
It was like 3-2 beer in Utah.
But it became like a standard, 80 proof. And that was the time period in which Gentleman Jack's introduced and people were going, I'm going to drink less, but I'm going to drink better. People were looking for lower proof whiskeys. And so what we told people is like, look, if you really like – Jack Daniels at 86 proof, put one less ice cube in your drink if you're drinking it with ice. I met one guy who said, you know, I wouldn't dilute my whiskey with ice or water. I just won't dilute it. I go, wow, okay. There's a lot of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no,
we
no,
know
no.
a couple of those.
Yeah.
I'm serious. He goes, yeah. I am so serious that I don't even open my eyes when I'm drinking. I go,
What
in the world? He says, yes, because if I look at the whiskey, I'll salivate. and that will dilute my whiskey. So he may have been the most serious person. But yeah, so the move to a higher proof is, quite frankly, Jack is really, really good, as you've experienced. At 100 proof, it's complex. There's a lot of flavor there. If you're mixing it in a cocktail, it holds up. So, and the world of whiskey drinkers, a lot have happened, guys. Like, we have Uber drivers. You know, there was seriously a worry at that time period about drinking and driving. Mm-hmm. It's still a worry and a concern. But nowadays, we have so many different ways to avoid that,
right,
whether it's Uber, whatever it is. And I think people are more open to a higher proof whiskey, just in general as a society.
Well, certainly. I mean, a lot of the crew that listens to this on the Dakota Territory Whiskey Group, I mean, a lot of these guys are drinking barrel proof stuff and almost won't settle for less, right? Mm-hmm. And then some of the guys I saw, Jesse, he put in on his trip to Kentucky, put in a Coy Hill 144 into his bag, I think, today.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you make a good point, and I've said it before, that the Coy Hill at that high 138 to 145 proof or whatever that range is, you would think would just almost melt your face off. And when I had it, the few times that I've had it, I couldn't get over how much flavor it had.
Yeah, yeah. People are really amazed by that because you would think the burn. And that's kind of how we got into the higher proof. The barrel proof whiskeys that we do is different people, as they were being trained at Jack Daniel's, would go into the barrel houses. And one of the things we do with everybody who's, you know, learning more about the brand they're selling is they'll try it from the barrel. And everybody that sipped that barrel would go, oh, my goodness, this is amazing. And it's not got the burn. Now, I'm talking about whiskey drinkers here. Some people, you know, it wouldn't be their cup of tea. And so, yes, people are more interested in a higher proof. We have a number of ways now. I think people have heard the responsibility message to the point that they are being more responsible in their drinking. And so, you know, hopefully we're more adult. We've heard that message. We can get an Uber. And so slightly higher proof whiskeys. Although I'm a huge advocate. If I'm drinking Coy Hill, it's only at home.
It has to be.
that's a good plan.
Right. Yeah, it is. A big part of Jack, of course, is, you know, they tout. And if you ever take the tour, Rob and I we've both taken it. We've both been there. And it's an experience that if you're a whiskey drinker, and even if you're not, you know, I took my wife and my kid on the tour, and they both were like, this is just, it's amazing to see.
I describe it as Disney World for adults.
Yeah.
It's just awesome.
It really is. And one part of the tour is they take you by that spring water that you get to walk by, which is obviously a huge part of what makes Jack Daniel's successful. Is there, and I've thought about this before, and I don't know if you can answer this question or not, is there ever worry about something happening to that?
Oh, yeah.
Do the people at Jack think, God dang, what if something?
That is kind of, it's the reason we're there.
Right.
It's the reason we're not making it somewhere else. We're so far off a main road. That's additional trucking, when you're making whiskey for 170 countries, the additional miles you have to do, you better have something in Lynchburg, and you're making it in a dry county. Why? We've had other counties petition us to come make whiskey there. You know, say you're closer to the interstate, blah, blah, blah. But we make it in Lynchburg, the people, number one.
Right.
And number two, that water source, you're absolutely right. The minerals in the water source, it's going through limestone, so it's naturally filtered and imparted with minerals that the yeast really thrive on to do a great, great job. So, yeah, the water is huge. And, we've had 200-year droughts before.
Right.
And we've never run out of water with a 200-year drought. But just to be safe, if you go to Google Maps and you Google map Lynchburg, Tennessee, you'll see this enormous object on one of the hills. And what that is a 10 million gallon tank.
Wow.
So we pump it up the hill to this 10 million gallon tank. So we've never even had a period where, when you go to the Cave Spring today, you're going to see it running.
Yeah.
And we're pumping out water at that very moment. Like, we're pumping out tons of water. Chris Fletcher could tell you exactly how many gallons per second.
I'm sure.
I'm sorry, but I can't do that. But we're pumping out, and it's still got plenty of water. So we are really close. And the 10-million-gallon tank just ensures that. And that happened. We put that 10-million-gallon tank up on the hill after that 200-year drought, just to make – because that's when we started asking questions. What if?
Yeah.
We found another spring on the property that could add to it. It's from the same aquifer, same spring. It's just a – it's a cave spring, so it's popping up different places. So we've got that on the distillery ground. We're not using it, but we know it's there. So, yeah, that's a serious thing. And, you know, Jack, when he started at the Dancall place, if he'd stayed there, we owe it to Jack that he moved to the Cave Spring. Other distillers were there.
Oh, they were? That was going to be my next question, is how he just got there first.
Well, no. Jack was more like Steve Jobs than he was Thomas Edison. And by that I mean he didn't invent anything.
Right.
He brought the best together. So, Jack, there were 15 other distillers. They were all charcoal milling their whiskey. Jack changed his charcoal out more often and so had a better product. He knew that was the best water source in the county. So as soon as the lease went up or whatever, he pounced on that property. And we feel like he owned it. We know he owned it by 1884. And we've been there ever since. Every drop of Jack Daniel's you've enjoyed. You know, I can drink Lynchburg bottled water with a little, you know, medicinal whiskey in it the world over. And it's all coming from that spring.
That's what's so amazing to me, is that has been supplied. And is it kind of a secret? I mean, is there how much land
we've
is owned?
Just told 12 of people.
I know. No, well, I mean, how much, you know, I'm assuming you have to keep where it comes from kind of.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're
it has
right.
to be safe.
It sounded like you were going, and the answer is yes.
Right.
We have bought up property from what we call, you know, where it fills, the charge, where the water comes. We've bought a property, or we've signed deals with farmers that they wouldn't fertilize or have
that was my
cattle
question,
and
yep.
whatnot on the land.
Perfect.
So,
yeah.
Yes, we protected acreage.
So, you're buying, just protecting so that nobody else taps into the spring.
Well, more than anything, so nobody, you know, dumps anything.
Yeah, the runoff.
Yeah, that also, sure, even yeah. fertilizer.
Right.
You don't want that.
No.
Yeah.
All right, Nelson, if we can hold you over for one more time here, that'd be great, if you wouldn't mind, okay?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Mark Houston, the host of Doc Talk with Monument Health.
I tell people every organ in your body that has a blood vessel is affected by cardiovascular disease, by definition.
The average prostate in a young man in his 20s is about the size of a walnut, and it can grow to the size of a softball.
He always tells the patient when we're together, he's like, I'm the kind of doctor that you want to see so you don't see my wife. So I really don't want our path to cross in the,
right.
the clinic.
Doc Talk from Monument Health. Wherever you get your podcasts.
Back again with Nelson Eddy, the historian with Jack Daniel's. One thing that's popped into my mind just talking with you here, Nelson, you know, referencing Jack, the person himself. Did he ever get to see the popularity of Jack? Did he get to see, was he just there at the beginning, or did he know before he passed away, this is something?
Okay, yes and no. Okay. And the reason I say that is in 1904, you have the World's Fair in St. Louis. And to give you an idea how big World's Fairs were in that time period, there was another event that was going to happen in Chicago. But because the World's Fair was happening, they moved their event to St. Louis, where the World's Fair was. It was the Olympics. They knew they wouldn't have a draw because St. Louis had the World's Fair. So they moved the Olympics to St. Louis.
Wow.
And so Jack and family get on a train, go to St. Louis. He takes his whiskey. And I can only imagine the scene. So you've got these big whiskey makers from around the world. And this little guy from Lynchburg, Tennessee.
And Jack was
two,
little.
Oh,
yeah.
He's 5 foot
small
two.
Small dude.
5 foot two. And we think that's why he tried harder. He just was always making up for this. And they called him the boy distiller, not because he was that young. It's just he was so small. And so he walks away with his gold medal. And it was so contentious and controversial that it wasn't even published in the newspaper because the big distillers were so angry. But he meets a gentleman from England who says, you need to be involved in our whiskey competitions in Europe. And that gentleman, who was a judge, helps get Jack Daniels to win some of those other gold medals we'll win. So Jack had a hint that he had something really, really good. But he will die when Tennessee's dry. So he will see his whiskey distillery in Lynchburg. He'll die in 1911. And the laws enacted in 1909, so 1910, it's fully dry, the state is. And so he'll see his whiskey cease to be made in Lynchburg, Tennessee. His nephew Lem will take the distilling business to St. Louis, operate for a while. There'll be a fire there. He's got a brother down in Alabama. He'll make whiskey there. And Alabama goes dry. Eventually, the whole country goes dry, and Lem just stops. And he won't make whiskey again until Prohibition's over. But Jack, he must have thought it was done.
Right.
I'm starting to understand why Jack was mad at the safe.
Well, now that story's got to be, what's the truth to that?
Well, it's true. You know, when they tell it on tour, you kind of get the sense he kicked the safe and he fell over dead.
Yeah.
You know, because they'll say, here's the murder weapon, mm-hmm. You know, and it's still the safe we have down there. And that's the office that Jack did business out of. But, you know, it's not immediate. Okay. So he kicks the safe. He breaks his big toe. He's a proud guy. He doesn't tell anybody. From descriptions of him at that time period, he's heavy set. He's more rotund. And we kind of get the feeling maybe he was diabetic because maybe the circulation to his limbs wasn't what it should be, because a broken toe shouldn't end up in gangrene, but it did. And so he has the toe amputated, later the foot, and then eventually his entire leg is removed. And as much as anything, to go through that series of operations in that day and age, eventually he will die, mm-hmm. whether it was the operations or, you know, the fact that this was spreading through his system, we can't tell. But it was a rather gruesome way to go. Mm. And that's why he signs his, while he's still living, in 1907, he gives his distillery to Lem Motlow and Dick Daniel. And Dick Daniel, seeing Prohibition on the horizon, he sells his half to Lem. And at the time, he was probably considered the smartest man in Moore County. After Prohibition, people's idea of that changed.
So did Lem just shut it down during Prohibition?
In Tennessee, shut it down.
And he just was hoping to ride it out, in essence, or did he?
I don't know what he thought, but you know, he'll do it in St. Louis, and he'll do it. And then 1919, decade later, 10 years later, the whole country goes dry. Mm-hmm. So he's got to shut down everywhere. He'll sell off the stock that he has over time, and then he'll make his money with mules. He'll sell mules. He'll sell Tennessee walking horses. He'll sell farming implements. He has a general store on the square. He's an officer at the bank. So he's got income coming. But he does all of his work under this Jack Daniels, Lem Motlow proprietor. And you go, well, why do you do that? He protected the trademark. Because after Prohibition, another distiller out of New York started making Jack Daniels. Because he didn't think Lem was coming back. 33, it's repealed. It's after that, he's not coming back. So he starts making, Lem fights it and wins. And
he protected it for that long.
He protected the trademark.
Boy, there are a couple instances in this history where it could have just been over for Jack, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's interesting.
It really
with
is.
All the trademark stuff that we've gone through here, with the rally and everything
exactly.
else.
Yeah.
Did they know, did they think that Prohibition was forever when it first started? Were most of those distillers like, this is it, we're never going to make it here again? Or did some think, I mean, obviously Lem had the foresight to hold on to that.
Right. Well, I think they were like maybe us with COVID. You know?
Sure.
the first, we think it'd be the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. Like, remember?
Yes, exactly. Right.
3 months, we'll be done.
Right.
Well, they probably thought, hey, it'll be a year, and then people will be sick and tired of this, and they kept going on. So I think initially they probably thought, yeah, it'll come back. People aren't going to stand for this. Mm-hmm. But over time, you had to kind of wonder. So
yeah, because what was the range of prohibition? How many years was it?
Well, it was what? It was till it was like 1920 to 33.
So yeah, about 13 years. Yeah, boy, that about 5 years in, you had to be thinking, oh man, this is this is over. We're never getting it back.
What's interesting is we had a guy by the name of John Nance Garner, who was vice president under Roosevelt, who was from Texas, and he had some Jack Daniel's whiskey, and he let Lem know that he was striking a blow for liberty. And what he meant by that is he would drink his Jack Daniels in his Washington office. So there were still, you know, some cases that have been held back. We weren't making it then. Yeah. But
so one of those Washington, D.C. things, just do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly,
well,
sort of.
Politicians love whiskey because of the taxes.
Of course.
An enormous amount of tax.
Yeah, there is. Do you have, I mean, as many years as you've been, 37 years, you've been a historian with Jack. When you've been learning this throughout the entire time, you've been giving these speeches and talks, and there has to have been a few things to you that really stand out in this history that maybe even surprised you, that you thought, wow, That's really, really interesting. Is there anything off the top of your head like that?
Wow.
That kind of stand out for you, or
you take a whole lot for granted. I will tell you this: that somebody as young as a Jack Daniels, the story of Nearest Green, when that became more popular, you know, this just tells you how much people read in America. The only biography that was there were two biographies that were written on Jack Daniels prior to 2016, when the whole Nearest Green story went crazy. They both told the story of Nearest Green.
Really?
They both told the story. If there's one thing that they didn't mention was that he was the distiller. And they didn't mention that because we didn't have all the paperwork together. And I'll have to tip my hat to Fawn Weaver. Mm-hmm. She was very interested in the story. And for a large segment of the populace, it was a cultural story, and Nearest was a cultural icon. And I totally get it. And Fawn Weaver, that was important to her, really important to her. If there was anything that we didn't do right, we didn't understand how important a story that was. And so Fawn Weaver came in, and she had 30 researchers researching and doing and uncovered some things. And with that and some things that we found in looking, that we put together. And so he was named the first master distiller once we had all that documentation.
And of course, Fawn Weaver is the owner and Uncle Nearest.
Right.
Which is just right down the road from you guys, really.
Down the road in Shelbyville. Some people think of her as a competitor. I think of her as a good friend. She shared all the research she's done. There's the Nearest and Jack Initiative now. She wants to, you know, have a fully running, operating distillery, and she wants to have, you know, employ a minority. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough people in the industry to do that. So the Nearest and Jack Initiative is to get more people into the industry and to get over that barrier. And we're doing that through, you know, getting people to a distilling school, by helping people advance their career in the whiskey business, by even helping other distillers who are minority-owned in sourcing barrels or bottling product to help them get started, whatever it is. So that's all been good. And so it's as Jack and Nearest, I tell people I think Jack would be proud that Nearest has a distillery with his name on it.
He would have to be, almost, you would think. I mean, and they were good friends, weren't they, according to the most of the history you read?
The only photo we have of Jack and his crew, this is turn of the century in the American South when, you know, Jim Crow is at its height. And there's Jack Daniels, and to his right, in this shot of all these people, his nephew is sitting down below him.
Right.
But to his right is an African-American. You go, who is that guy? It's the son of Nearest Green. And so, yeah, there was a great deal of respect shared. Fawn is coming out with a book. We had a book in the past done about Jack, and it was called Blood and Whiskey. And her book is called Love and Whiskey. And the reason she gave it that name is to really say there was something going on here. And she's done enough research and dealt with the family long enough. Who am I to dispute with what she's discovered on that? So there was some kind of a bond there. And, you know, unless you were there at the time, you can never fully understand it.
Exactly. What do you think? What's the future look like for Jack then?
Oh, wow.
I mean, we've talked quite a bit about Jack. You know, you mentioned that Jack was kind of the Steve Jobs, and I guess Nearest would kind of be the Wozniak then,
yeah.
Right? In a way, so to speak. So Jack hasn't been the first when it comes to the flavored whiskeys, when it comes to, you know,
the age statements, the
different types, but they always seem to keep the essence of Jack in the stuff that they create. Mm-hmm. They don't rush it out just to be part of the herd mentality of the stuff that's out there, which I think to Jack's credit is why they do so well with everything that comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right. We're not going to be on the bleeding edge. We're going to take our time. For example, Tennessee honey, a lot of honey flavored whiskeys or liqueurs, they'll taste almost medicinal. Well, the way Jack, the thing that they did is they took four or five, I can't remember exactly which, it was either four or five different honeys and blended them together. And it's that combination that made it full, more complex. And so you had, yeah, I know a serious whiskey drinker will look at Tennessee honey and maybe turn their head. Mm-hmm. But if they saw the quality and what research and the time it took to develop this proprietary mixture of all these different honeys to get where they got, I mean, there's a reason it's not the cheapest on the market among what people call flavored whiskeys. But it's because of the quality. And the same's true of the cinnamon that's used
in fire. The fire, that's what I was just going to say.
You know, and the Tennessee apple comes out of this. You know, in Germany, they wanted apple. And the Germans are so particular, so exacting about what kind of apple it had to be, that I'm awfully glad that it came out of Germany before it got to us. And they just were very exacting. And so it's those kinds of things that have made what we do a little bit different. I mean, the recent Bonded series, you know, people thought of us as, yeah, you're just cranking out Old Number 7. Well, if you come visit the distillery, it's not cranked out. It's all, you know, a single barrel is the smallest batch you'll ever have.
Right.
It's a single barrel. So, you know, craft isn't about size. It's about quality, we choose to believe. And so this Bonded series is really to let people know, hey, we're just really, really good distillers because we have a rye. And, oh, by the way, in this triple malt or in this triple mash, we have an American malt that we're making in that. And people said, what? You can make a malt? Yes. And if you travel internationally now, you can find Jack Daniel's American malt at duty free.
Yes.
I have to fly to Switzerland to see my grandkids just so I can come back with a bottle of that whiskey.
We got lucky enough to, one of our coworkers went to London and France and came back with a bottle for us. So
yeah. And it's delicious. Of course it is. They just, that's the one thing Jack has done well. And I think it's, you know, it's a testament to what Jack himself started, right? I mean, it's all about quality. Yeah. And you make it the best that you can every day.
And when if you've got a whiskey like Old Number 7, you're very careful that nothing you do puts a bad spin on that reputation of 150 years.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to be the guy that messed it up or gal or anyone.
Well, Nelson Eddy, man, this has been a lot of fun. I'm so glad you took time to come up here. Glad you're back in the area. And if we can ever entice you back to the rally, you'll have a place to hang out for sure. Okay.
All right.
Nelson Eddy, historian with Jack Daniel's. Thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate
it. Really appreciate it. Thanks for coming in, Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Whiskey at Work. I am the producer and host, Mark Houston, along with Rob Henry. Our shows are engineered by Chris Jaquist, and the video and audio editing is done by our own Russ Haddon. If you like what you hear, we would love a 5-star review wherever you rate your podcast, and leave us a comment as well. It's Whiskey at Work on the Home Slice Audio Network.